now that theme song you've all been waiting for, and of course the show that nobody can be without, Bathrop Spears Broadsides, the February 4th version, special interviews from Portland, updates on the upcoming injunction trial of the Coffee Klatch 3, a special interview with San Francisco Liberation Radio's Richard Edmondson, and more. Stay tuned.
Harry Truman, Doris Day, Red China, Johnny Ray, South Pacific, Walter Winchell, Joe DiMaggio, Joe McCarthy, Richard Nixon, Studebaker, television, North Korea, South Korea, Marilyn Monroe.
Today, it's, of course, February 4th, 2001, and this is your Sunday edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides, Civil Rights on the Streets. Twice weekly, we get to give it to you, and sometimes we get it back in the pusser here. Last time on Thursday, from 6 to 8 is the other time for this show, I got a very harsh and hostile call right before I went off the air from a woman who took strong exception to what I was doing on a number of fronts. She thought the radio show was trash. She was extremely upset at my criticizing police behavior on the streets of Santa Cruz. And it's interesting, I was taken quite aback by this, but indeed, some people do feel this way, and if we are to fairly represent the views of everyone in the community, including people who I would regard as misinformed and bigoted, we should indeed allow them their say, and I perhaps gave her a little too much time to talk, but she did speak, and I'm going to play a little bit of what she was saying as a sort of an introduction to an incident that happened on January 20th. That's the Bush inauctional, as some called it, where, quote, President, unquote, Bush was given the official, his papers and now rules over all of us. There was a couple of things that happened that day, the most famous of which, or the most notorious of which, was the police failure to take a meaningful action around the issue of a bicyclist who was hit by a motorist, Joe Gutierrez. That's Sean was hit by this motorist, and I was actually on the scene, got some tapes of that, and the Metro covered it in some detail, and they're still trying to cover it, though the police are covering up big time, it looks like, as is their usual practice. Anyway, after that whole thing happened, after the court, there was a rally at the courthouse around Bush, and Emperor Tim Fitzmaurice spoke, trying to be a good anti-Bush guy for his progressive constituents, along with Mayor Sleeping Ban Is My Baby Keith Sugar. He was also there I walked back up down the mall, or up the mall, and I ran into an incident where police were harassing a man who was displaying his artwork in front of the Palomar Hotel. And they ended up giving him a ticket, which at the very least was probably about $160, and if he doesn't make the court appearance, it'll go up to $270. This is a guy named Daryl, I believe. He was very demoralized when I talked to him later, but at the time he was standing up for himself, and I, too, tried to spread the word about what the police were doing. There was quite a number of cops there. There was a CSO, a police officer in light blue. There was an officer in darker blue. There was a sergeant. There was a lieutenant, Lieutenant Sapone. I mean, there were at least four police officers. And I think there was a host or two nearby observing the whole process of, you know, how to harass a poor person who is not blocking the sidewalk, who is not causing any trouble, who is actually contributing to the life of Pacific Avenue by showing these pieces of artwork, and indeed perhaps even looking for money from them. Although he was saying he was doing it for donation, that wasn't enough for them. They were going to go after him anyway. So first I'm going to play a little bit of what one critic had to say about me at the last show, kind of to get the fire burning. Remember, we didn't start the fire. And then you get to hear what's actually going on the streets. Unfortunately, the tape is not the best tape. I apologize in advance. This had to be the day I had the crappy tape recorder, the day that we had the bicyclist who got hit and the motorist who actually gave me an interview, which I think is now on the internet, by the way. I think Sean put it up on the internet. Sean Duncan, I believe his name is, the victim, I think the Metro riders are still looking for the police report, or the police report is completely inadequate in terms of not having adequate witnesses for that. But let's go over to the whole issue of what do you do when you see cops harassing people on the streets? Well, here's what one woman thinks about the process when you speak up. She doesn't like it, and here's what she had to say last show.
Let's go to, you raised a couple important issues. The second issue you raise is, what am I doing on the mall when I do what I call a cop watch, which is to say when a police officer comes up and begins to harass a poor person for
He's not harassing. I've watched the police officer. When they're coming up, they're giving the people a ticket for a reason, and that's between them and the police officer, not you.
Well,
you're
know.
Coming along
Member
making a huge nuisance of the matter when it doesn't even need to be made.
Well, so do you agree that a person who is sitting...
But that's not your business, is it?
Well, sure. I'm a member
no,
of the community, just
business,
like it's your
though.
Business to express your opinion as you're doing
but
right
I'm
now.
But I'm calling you right now. I'm not calling a police officer. I'm not butting into the affairs of someone who could actually have the ticket dismissed and handle things on their own matter,
you know,
on their own accord. But you come along and make it a big issue when it shouldn't even be an issue.
Well,
you
no,
sit there. I've watched you before, and you yell, and you don't help the matter, really.
Well, actually,
at all.
What I do is I announce to the public that the police are spending public money
going
after people. They're using public money going after people, let's say, for sitting down on the sidewalk.
Because there's rules to where these people should be sitting, and they're sitting there
day
long.
You know, the police made rules about the Jews in Germany in the 30s. Do you think we should have just sort of let them do that? Would that have been a good idea?
The police who made those rules.
No,
that
but
was
they
a
were
political
important.
Party. That was a totally different situation.
Right. Well, the fact of the matter is,
you're trying to make it like it is the Nazis.
Wait a minute.
You're a Nazi yourself.
Wait a minute. The police enforced those rules. The police were the people that went and arrested those people.
It was the government that went and arrested. It was the Nazis that went and arrested.
Hey, the
and
police
you're
force.
Not helping the matter
the police
either.
Force
like
did what
the
they
Nazis
were told.
Themselves.
Wait a minute, no caller. I think you're mistaken. The police force followed what the Nazis told them to do.
Are we really on the topic of the Nazis? We're on the topic of
well,
you.
Some people
who tries to contradict everybody and be
caller,
the world's biggest hypocrite.
Some people consider that laws that make it criminal to ask for a dime after dark is kind of repressive, similar to the kind of legislation that Nazis began within the 30s. There really are people who
you're
feel
that
way.
You're trying to compare that, but it's not even a comparison, really. It
well,
really isn't.
There are some who believe it is.
You just want some soapbox to stand on because you don't have a life to get it together for yourself. You know, what do? You go around thinking that you're really a supporter and a provider for people's rights when you're totally not.
Well,
you're just trying to, like, you have nothing better to do.
And there's more of that. As those of you who were listening last week know, the caller got pretty personal, and she was pretty angry at me personally for doing what you're about to hear me do on this somewhat less-than-perfect tape on January 20th, when, as I said, a man who's an artisan was sitting in front of the Palomar Hotel on Pacific, not blocking traffic, and I came upon this scene.
So it's about 15 after 2 in front of the El Palomar, and it looks like Lieutenant Sassoni, Sergeant Baker, and another police officer, a female police officer, are taking some action regarding a man on the sidewalk who had some of his artifacts displayed. He is apparently being told to move, or no, he's I'm not sure what he's doing. He's putting them out again. Excellent. You're getting a ticket. What are you getting a ticket for, sir?
Robert? Let us, you can talk to them. You want to publicity? I mean, look how many cops are here, you know? You know what I'm saying?
Your police department at work, folks. Hassling artisans on the street. Come and take a look. Why don't you let him do his job? Why don't you let him do his job? Police officers harassing artisans on the street. Santa Cruz, the way you like it. Police department harassing local artisans. Check it out. Is it rape? Is it murder? No, it's an artisan showing his stuff. Hassled by our Santa Cruz Police Department. Check it out. Hi. And taking pictures, folks.
You're showing my work, right? You have your copy? Right? Am I right? Well, it's the same thing. You were just arrested. Actually, I can only tell you that you did get arrested the night of the week. Hey, do you have your copy?
We have to.
Your taxpayer dollars at work, folks.
Yeah, I want to.
Santa Cruz police hassling an artisan here on the streets.
Hey, Robert. Don't scream at your Masonic. Don't scream at the fucking Masonic.
Tell them there's a better way to be spending police dollars than harassing poor people and artisans on Pacific Avenue, because some people want to turn this town into a Disneyland West. Isn't that the truth? Ask yourselves. 420-5017. Call the city council hotline now. Tell them to stop this.
Why is he getting a ticket?
Why are you getting a ticket?
I was showing my artwork. I was showing it out here.
What do you have? Like jewelry or something? Or what?
No, I have the artwork. The art that I did. And I was showing it. And they said that I either sign a ticket or I get arrested. I go to jail for showing my artwork. That's it. Those were the choices I was given.
You have to have...
There's a law against displaying, quote, merchandise. The police are choosing to regard his artwork as merchandise. Say that again.
I love looking at the art, you know, that's displayed on the mall. You know, it makes it very colorful, the way it used to be. Not like that.
Thank you. So what's your name, sir?
Derek Williams.
Derek, how long have you been doing this?
Well, since I moved here and been homeless for like 5 months.
So you've been doing this for about 5 months. Where do you sleep at night?
Wherever I can, generally. Mostly on the street.
And have you been hassled before?
Yeah, several times, several occasions.
Is this the first you've gotten? This is the first time you...
Yeah, before I've always been able to dispute it successfully.
Right. So you just got a $5 bill from a woman who just walked out of Pacific Trading Company. I am very impressed.
Yeah, me too. I mean, if people still have a sense of compassion, I mean, no matter, like, really where you are. You know.
So you say you've gotten tickets for this before?
Yeah, I've never gotten a ticket for this before. This is the first time that they've asked it. I've been harassed, like, 4 different occasions.
Unfortunately, that particular tape recorder was a loser, and we got constant stops. But you got some of the idea. I, again, ran into Derek later, and as I said, he was very demoralized. He felt that he, as a homeless person, he couldn't even leave town until he dealt with his ticket because he didn't want it to turn into a warrant. He felt very gloomy about the whole prospect. A couple of comments about the critic who called in, who I understand may actually be... in some way connected with the Free Radio Collective, but that's fine. We have a wide divergence of views here. It really is a difficult situation for a person. First of all, the laws are set up and they're rigged against the poor. I mean, if you have the money to get a business license, there's no problem. You're being out on the mall. You see the merchants do it all the time. They put their little shoe stands out there. They got their kiosks out there. They're selling their trinkets up and down the mall when they choose to do so. However, for example, if you're a poor person, it becomes a question to some extent of officer discretion. So, for example, there's a fellow in front of Borders who reads tarot cards, who I don't think gets hassled much, a poet who doesn't get hassled a lot, though I'm sure that they probably have a story or two to tell you as well. But here's a man who wasn't blocking the sidewalk, who wasn't harassing people, who wasn't even engaging in some sort of big-time commercial enterprise. And he needed the support of the community. And more important, the police need to know when the community doesn't like what it's doing. Police are very intimidating by their very nature. Their point is they're supposed to be a force. They have lethal force with them, which they can and have used in Santa Cruz. They can use violence without really having any responsibility or accountability. Though we have what's called the Citizens Police Review Board. I've often described it as the Citizens Police Rah-Rah Board or Rubber Stamping Board. It doesn't meaningfully review the police, and it doesn't do so in any way that gives the citizenry a chance to respond to issues. So the best place to deal with these issues is where they happen. And indeed, you can effectively stop police harassment or moderate it or ameliorate it by bringing a bunch of people around to observe. Some people would say, oh, you're just polarizing a situation, you're making it harder on the guy because the policeman feels she or he is losing face and then has to, do something more. Actually, what usually happens is they do less. They back off. I've seen this happen in Berkeley. I've seen this happen in Santa Cruz. You can't always judge that that's what's going to happen. But what you do find, and I'm going to answer this caller, so hang in there, caller. I'm going to pick up the line in just a moment. What you do find is that there is an effect. The police become aware that they can't just capriciously harass people as they do frequently at spots like New Leaf Market. I mean, we're also talking about harassing under the drug war, the war against the poor. We're talking about harassing under the downtown ordinances, to sit on the sidewalk with 10 feet from a store, get a ticket, to ask for a dime after dark, do it twice, 6 months in jail, $1,000 fine. I think there is a real meaningful place for citizen response to this, and let's see what the public out there has to say.
Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, Robert. This is V-Man, and this is slightly off topic, but on the issue of lethal force, I'm curious if you read yesterday's Sentinel.
Point me to the article you're thinking of.
It was on the front page, I believe, at the bottom of the front page. It was an article about a man in Soquel with a toy gun.
Uh-huh.
And Officer James Thurber, Deputy James Thurber.
Oh, yes. I saw that, but I didn't read it carefully. Maybe you can give us your thoughts on that.
Well,
tell us what happened, what the article was about.
What happened was a man had allegedly brandished a toy gun, and the police were called, the sheriffs were called out. It was in Soquel or Aptos or somewhere out there. And James Thurber was the responding officer, and he ended up... Luckily, the man did not get shot and killed. It was, the guy was arrested and charged with brandishing a toy gun. The thing that that concerns me here is that the Sentinel, in their infinite wisdom, made a big blunder in that article, because they made a reference to Happy John Dine, to the John Dine killing by Officer Connor Carey in 97, where, and I know you're very familiar with this case, and it was like trumpeted all over the media that John Dine took a combat stance and pointed a toy gun at officers and was gunned down. Well, in the Sentinel yesterday, they made this reference to how luckily this man in Soquel, it wasn't a tragic outcome like in the John Dine case. And they go on to refresh people's memory of the John Dine case in this article. And I don't have it in front of me to reference, but they made a statement in the article which contradicts everything that they have printed and reported in the past. And the statement was that John Dine, after being shot, it was later determined that a toy gun was found near his waist. Now, this totally, I read this, and my mind, kind of freaked, flipped out, because I remember when this happened, and I remember they kept saying the combat stance, and that he pointed the gun, and da-da-da, and all the witnesses that were non-police witnesses in the John Dine killing all said that he had not anything in his hand, he didn't point anything at the officers, but the papers and the police reports always said that. Now, suddenly, they're retracting that and saying, they just threw it in there, that he the weapon, the toy gun, was found near his waist. And it just, it's just very, I don't know, I was just curious if you had read that.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. I didn't do the detail that you did, and I'm glad you did, because I'll go back to that article. You're, of course, you know, referring to a case, a very notorious case, which provoked great protests, extensive protests downtown and at the police review board, and, of course, eventually no action whatsoever from the police department or the citizens police rah-rah board.
Right.
What the story was, of course, as you said it, is that within 3 hours after Dine was shot, the police department, through the sergeant and the chief Belcher, had come out with their man in a combat stance, pointing a weapon at an officer, in a visible way, gun was in his hand. And then within 12 hours, you had the district attorney, then Art Danner, holding a press conference from which... I think Free Radio Santa Cruz, was it? Were you excluded?
I was excluded, myself, as well as Phil Free and you.
I was excluded, too, and I guess the only person that got in, luckily for us, was Becky Johnson with a video camera. She videoed the entire press conference that Danner did, which Danner repeats this fable about, you know, dying supposedly visibly with a weapon, combat stance, acting in a threatening manner. All these allegations were contradicted or found not happening. There was no evidence for them by every single non-police related witness, and there were more than 10 of them,
mm-hmm.
Including, you know, respectable citizens like the Plumleys, who have a candy store in town, Alani Balawager, who still works at New Leaf Market, Michael Schultz, and I guess his partner, who testified that it was murder. As far as they were concerned, and she actually threw a press conference at the DA's office.
I interviewed those people on the scene, and within 10 minutes of the shooting, and they, you know, I got their I still have that tape, and they repeatedly said there was nothing in his hand, and that it was murder.
You interviewed Tom Murphy, he was very eloquent. Perhaps isn't the word. He was eloquent. He was very upset. He was very specific about what he saw happen, and then he left town. He apparently was threatened by police several times and then left town. That was his story later. The CPRB then, 2 months later, changed the story because the story was, it didn't hold together, and then Mayor Celia Scott insisted that the report be put in the library, the district attorney's report. The only reason we got to see the investigation and the interviews of the officers was because Dine was dead and there was no lawsuit pending. He had no relatives who were willing to file a lawsuit, so the city, you know, didn't cover up the report. But if it happened, if somebody else had been shot, like Brian Andrus, who was shot a year later,
five months later.
Right, at the Button Street Apartments. That case is still, it hasn't reached the CPRB. It's been held on the deep freeze. This is where a guy was shot at least twice in the back by Sergeant Hennig, who's still on duty, as well as two other officers out of a total of four who broke into the home of he and his wife on Button Street. I'm kind of wandering here, but the basic point is that the CPRB found that it wasn't a weapon held out. It wasn't a weapon in a combat stance. It wasn't a weapon held in a threatening manner. It was reaching for a weapon.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly the story changed.
Right.
And so we've asked, I've repeatedly asked the CPRB and the city council members to reopen this case, if only to look at the lethal force policy guidelines that the police use. Why should they have to jump out and start firing, you know, in a lethal way? That they could have ducked behind their squad car. They didn't have to go after him that way. And, of course, there's evidence that he was targeted because he was a homeless activist and activist against police violence.
Yeah. Well, it just blew my mind to read that in the paper yesterday after, you know, hearing this whole town, you know, say how tragic it was, but the guy was holding a weapon, and everybody believes that. And then suddenly, in the paper, just nonchalantly, they threw it in there that suddenly the toy gun was found in his waist, near
right.
his waist.
And some would say that Officer Over pulled the gun from his waist after this incident happened and threw it down.
Yeah.
That indeed he did have a toy gun. He had a number of toy guns. That Over knew he had toy guns, and covered for his fellow officer in that way. And again, it's hard to tell. I wasn't there. You were actually closer to it than I was, Vinny, and you talked to people who were there, so you probably have more of a very gut-level sense of what the truth of the situation was. But for damn sure, there was never an independent investigation of it. An independent investigation can be important. I mean, we saw this long
delayed Diane Christensen investigation of the Steve Argue punching of Officer Lefebvre when Lefebvre attacked a woman and child at the May 1999 Yugoslavia anti-bombing protest. And there actually turned out to be four sustained complaints, at least two of them for excessive force, mm-hmm. which is almost unheard of in our town.
Yeah.
And that can happen when you have the independent investigation getting into it, although we, of course, don't get to see the independent investigation, even though that's the whole point of it. And no cops were even interviewed in the independent investigation because the police department was not cooperating and the city council lacks the guts to make them cooperate. So, I mean, I also think this goes back to the very reason I began playing these tapes and the incident we heard with Daryl on Pacific Avenue, where he's getting harassed, a homeless man, an artist, is getting harassed for showing his artwork, which, by the way, is, I also think, federally protected. It's not just, you know, a matter of it's a wrong thing for cops to do. I think it's probably illegal if one had the legal resources to follow it all the way. But, you know, had a bunch of people jumped out and said, what are you doing with those guns on Happy John Dine? They might not have shot him.
Yeah.
You know? They might not have shot him. And similarly at the Andrus residence and on Button Street 5 months later, if people started shouting, why are these police here? You know, they might have paused, pulled out a bullhorn, started negotiating, which is what they should have done, and done the right thing because suddenly they were under public scrutiny, and for a moment they were accountable. And that's what all that's about.
Yeah.
When I hit the streets in that way. But am I a big loudmouth? Go ahead. Tell us the truth, Vinny.
No comment.
Ah! All righty.
Bye.
Thank you. And the voice of the public is often harsh and uncompromising, but you just have to listen to them. Musical break here, and we'll be back. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. Before the break, let's take this caller. Hi there, you're on the air.
Robert, hi. Bob LaMonica here. I wanted to sound in on this topic regarding abuse of power briefly.
Uh-huh.
And so many of these things get down to who discredits whom.
Mm-hmm.
All right, and the idea of, I didn't listen to your show Thursday, but this concept that it's none of your affair and that you're exacerbating the situation when you intervene in something that may be abuse of power is rather ludicrous and frightening and leads right to a police state.
Well, can't we trust our police officers, Bob?
Absolutely not. No, not. Once again, who discredits whom? These guys are never wrong. How often do the police, and that includes the district attorney's office with the power to enforce, ever admit they're wrong? No, it's you that are wrong. You're wrong. You're wrong even for challenging their credibility. How dare you challenge the credibility of some police officer? Let me give you a situation in point that's not about the DA's office or the sheriff. Red Control had a booth at the farmer's market in the summer of 99.
The infamous Jim Howes incident.
Attempted to dismantle the booth, mm-hmm. and it happened for 1 week,
mm-hmm.
right? And I decided that, no, this is not going to continue. It can't, simply on the basis of political freedom of speech. You don't start a new program with the wood chip area at the farmer's market with rent control, with a petition drive for rent control. And so I made a round of calls saying that I was going to be back the following week.
You were told by Officer Howes that you couldn't set up that table, right?
To dismantle it or I would be cited.
Mm-hmm.
And they whipped out a 3-month-old ruling, if you will, by the city attorney that claimed that it was a tree-planted area and therefore, you know, qualified for a park that they could control it. So I went along with it for 1 week in order to not have a hassle. And the following week, I came back, and it blew over. The reason why is that they were wrong, and they would have looked like complete idiots. Now, I think cops deserve a certain degree of respect, but I have, at the age of 50, I've seen situations, both on a personal level and impersonal, where cops can be so blatantly, brutally wrong that one has to step in the name of citizenship, in the name of honor, in the name of respect, whatever you want.
Or just even supporting decent policing in the neighborhood. I mean, if you favor wanting to see community control of police, where police are actually, you know, instituting law and order in a way that is even-handed, then you have to take a part in that, or else.
I think one of the high notes of this struggle was the attempt by the Santa Cruz Citizen Police Review Board to review themselves undercover, that you exposed, Robert. The audacity of we're going to go undercover and do our little review and then most likely dismantle the thing rather than just having it exist as a joke, which is what it does,
mm-hmm.
primarily. Kind of attitude, you know, it's none of your affair.
Right. That of course, happened last February when the city was supposed to be meeting in a subcommittee with the half city council members, half citizens police review board members to figure out how to put into effect long proposed but often ignored reforms that would have given the Citizens Police Review Board theoretically some teeth. And what Mayor Sugar wanted to do was meet in closed session, and I, of course, and others, you were there too, Bob, declined to allow that to happen, saying this is a violation of the Brown Act, it needs to meet in a public process. And indeed, the attorney that they'd paid $10,000 for from Palo Alto, Bob Aronson, agreed with us and said, you can't hold this meeting unless you hold open meetings. And
absolutely.
Of course, and what Sugar did was he closed down all meetings for the next 6 months and didn't have any meetings at all. And Arnie Leff, as the chair of the board, has done the same thing.
I was there on your prompt. I want to say that. Let me get in one thing here about Judge Danner.
Mm-hmm.
Now, anyone that wants to look at the documented record, and this is documented beyond any dispute as far as I and many people are concerned, what happens is this, like many, many issues where we're talking about our own community, people wait for a bandwagon, and without the bandwagon, these kinds of things they ultimately get neutralized, all right? But the situation that produced the recall movement was Art Danner falsifying time cards, having time cards falsified for an assistant DA named Catherine Gardner that it was shown was snorting what was most likely cocaine on the job. So what they do is they pay her 17 weeks to sit at home. Her time cards are falsified as unavailable.
In the middle of an election campaign.
Right, exactly. In the middle of an election, overlapping an election. And
an election for DA.
Right, exactly. And one of the few comments that was made publicly by a well-placed public official, or former public official, John Laird, nobody else could have gotten away with that. That's very sincere and it's truthful. Nobody else could have gotten away with that act. This is the falsification of government records
mm-hmm.
by a high-ranking public official for political favor.
Well, you've also pointed out even before that incident happened that Danner was involved in an auto accident where essentially the victim was criminalized and he was exonerated without any kind of meaningful testing and so forth.
Which should have been the end, which showed how entrenched this double standard was. And I've seen these guys in practice. I saw Chief Deputy DA John Hopkins try to stage a rile at a political booth in the fall of 1996. These are scoundrels, and I'll say it publicly, scoundrels
mm-hmm.
who are never wrong, who use their ability to become immune in making statements to the press. A prosecutor enjoys qualified immunity. Now that's an exact quote from a demurrer.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Yeah, Art Danner was the at-fault drinking driver in a head-on collision, June 9th, 1987. Who gets the blood test? By the way, Jack Bassett was chief of police at that time here in Santa Cruz.
Yeah.
Who gets the blood test? It is not the at-fault drinking driver. It's the victim, Sandra Larson, in the hospital.
You know, I think that that's the reason that we need to be
vigilant.
We need to speak up, and I do think that speaking up when police are engaging in the enforcement of things like the sleeping ban or the sitting ban or, you know, ignoring reports where a bicyclist is hit by a motorist, this happened on January 20th, that's the only thing that's going to produce even a semblance of justice, in my view.
I think one of the fundamental ways to state this dilemma is that these guys are never wrong.
Right.
Who discredits whom? Robert, thank you for all your efforts in this community.
Sure. And thank you. Anything
those of us that are not afraid to speak out recognize.
Robert, remember, it's not always a matter. A lot of us are afraid to speak out, but we speak out anyway because we're more afraid not to speak out.
Well put.
Yeah.
All right. I will listen.
Hey,
take care.
Bye-bye.
You want to hear a story? Then I'll give out with a story. About it wouldn't hurt a fly, and it makes you hear new notes in the music. And you'll touch and feel and taste all the natural things in life. But what do you say? We cut the crap every day, in every way. There's somebody turning you on. There's somebody selling somebody's junk. There's somebody peddling stuff inside a package with a label. Buy a can or bottle or jar or a car. There's somebody selling dreams and lies. Is that what you do? You do? Well, it's up to you. You hook them your way, I hook them mine, and that's fine. Why do I do it? Every do-gooder asks me. Why do I do it? For the green Mr. Clean. Every day, in every way, there's somebody doping your mind. Oh, there's somebody making you crave somebody's shit. Oh, there's somebody getting you off with a free sample, starting a habit. Oh, then you buy and buy and buy and buy and buy and buy. There's somebody smacking it to you, oh, all the time. Is that what you do? You do? Good, lucky for you. You push it your way, I push it mine, and that's fine. And the price is going up. You push it your way, I push it mine, and that's fine.
And you're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. This is Bathrob Spears Broadsides. Our lines are open at 427-3772. So if you just tried to get in, or you want to get in, or, hey, the lines are here, and looks like we got a caller.
Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hey, why don't you just let the cops do their job?
Yeah, well, you know how it is. I'm just a troublemaker.
Yeah, just let them put poor people down.
Well,
that's a job, right?
The poor people belong on the bottom, right?
I saw the cops the other day on the corner of Mission or Highway 1 and River Street, where a lot of homeless people cross the street, sitting there, motorcycle cops on both sides of the road, giving out tickets to homeless people crossing the street.
Wow, and when was this?
This was last week. It was like, I think it was Wednesday.
And how many cops were involved?
Two.
And you saw them giving out tickets for what kind of criminal behavior?
For not making it across the street before, or actually it was for going out into the street after the traffic had turned, you know, there was a red light which was stopping traffic, and people will cross to halfway across because for people, especially people who walk slower, they have a hard time getting across there. You get halfway across and there's still a turn, people turning, but you can just wait for them in the center.
Right.
And people have gotten, a couple of homeless people I've talked to have gotten tickets, jaywalking tickets, for walking across there, for going before it turns green.
And this is a regular process. It happened, I know, a year ago. It happened 2 years ago. And also it happened in January. I don't know, did they have some sort of January, crap on the homeless day, or hassle homeless people trying to cross the street next to the homeless services center? Because I guess that's what you're talking about.
Yeah, a lot of homeless people are crossing there to get to the homeless services center.
How many tickets did you see?
Well, I saw one person stopped, and that's all I saw then. But then I talked to someone else who he walks with a cane. He's a disabled veteran, and he got a ticket too.
Well, we're talking to Steve Argue, the notorious newspaper vendor of Street Spirit, who is currently engaged in a lawsuit to try to, after they threw you in jail for 4 days and brutalized you in jail after brutalizing you on the sidewalk, and then came up with no charges whatsoever, and the whole thing was given the big rubber stamp by the Citizens Police Review Board. You've taken the case to federal court, right?
Yeah.
Any updates on that one? I know we talked about that a week or two ago, and you found the San Francisco police were, strangely enough, arresting you on phantom charges similar to the Santa Cruz police.
Right. I think possibly brought on because it was the same day I was negotiating in Oakland, brought on by the local police somehow. You know,
negotiating on
me.
on the very case we're talking about.
Right.
Newspaper case.
I had just taken the BART, and I was possibly followed because the negotiations involved the cops that I was suing, and I got picked up and arrested for phony charges, and then released after 3 hours without being charged.
And I know you're a poor person, so you can't afford to, let's say, depose the officers, to have the officers come into and testify as to what happened and how they justified arresting you for selling a peaceful sales of a street newspaper near New Leaf Market. But I understand they have a new story they're using they said they didn't arrest you for the paper, they arrested you because you're obstructing the sidewalk, but their latest story is now that they do arrest you for the paper because you weren't just displaying it, you were actually selling it, and that is illegal without a license. Is that their claim?
Yeah, that's what they're saying now, which is completely unconstitutional. You look at the First Amendment to the Constitution, it's very clear about not obstructing freedom of press.
Exactly, but even more to the point, although that's certainly to the point, is that for 2.5 years, they have not cited one individual since the time they brutalized you, because it was very clear that they're very, not just the First Amendment said that, but the law said that there's an exception for newspapers.
Right, and in fact, this past summer, I was selling newspapers, and a host got up in my face and told me I couldn't sell them, and I had asked him a couple times, just because he was telling me I couldn't sell them, if he wanted to buy one, and he went off. Oh, he went off on me really mad.
And when was this?
Last summer, and he called for cops to back him up, to have me arrested, and met up with the cops down the street. And a witness said that he was ready to sign something to have me arrested, and but then some word was given to leave me alone, and he came back and apologized very loudly and said that I was right, that I could sell newspapers. There was a guy who, a homeless guy who just went in to City Hall to see if he could get a license to sell newspapers.
Uh huh.
Since you know that was the claim that I needed a license,
mm-hmm.
and they wouldn't give him any information on how he could get a license to sell newspapers, and he also asked for how he could. Possibly sell his artwork, maybe get a license to do that. What they wound up doing is giving him information on panhandling, when panhandling's legal and illegal, you know, after dark, all that, but didn't give him any information on newspapers and how it would be legal to sell newspapers, which shows, you know, this is something that just completely stops you from doing it. If they enforce it that way.
But of course they don't. That's what's interesting. I mean,
Well, they don't because we put so much pressure on them.
Right. What I'm saying is, right, exactly. But you know, for the last 2.5 years, they have not enforced, arrested or cited anybody for selling a paper, and
right.
Now suddenly they're claiming it's illegal without a license because your case is in the courts and they don't
right.
want to be responsible for the damage they've caused you.
Right, exactly.
Now, you have a show, by the way, for all our listeners who don't know. It's at... It's on Saturday from noon to 3.
Yeah.
Anything interesting come up then that you want to summarize that you think is relevant here?
About what?
Oh, you know, contacts with the police that you think might be educational for the community to know about, your case.
Well, the main thing I was calling in about was just what I saw, you know, how they're giving these jaywalking tickets.
Gotcha.
And I myself... got a jaywalking ticket too, which I'm going to have to go in and deal with, which I wasn't even, they said I was crossing on a red light. It was on Ocean Street, and in fact the light was green.
When did you get this ticket?
Like a month ago.
Well, I know that they kind of like giving you jaywalking tickets. They gave you jaywalking tickets a couple years ago, right?
Well, yeah, well, last year they did. I was stopped 3 times by the same officer for jaywalking.
He's just being very dutiful there, Steve.
Yeah, and you know, they're expensive, and it's a real pain. This officer, she got out of her car. She came up like 2 blocks up, got out of her car, and she said, "Mister Argue, was there a reason why you were crossing on that red? And I said, no, I wasn't. Oh, yes, you were, Mr. Argue. And, you know, it was obvious just harassment.
Right, I had the same thing happen to me, and I'm going to court for it in a week on the case of a stop sign downtown where I was, I passed two officers on the side. This was like down near the community television on Pacific Avenue. I continued driving along for a block in heavy traffic, finally parked my car in front of the hosts, and a minute or two later, this police car shows up and says, you know, we want to see your registration. We're going to give you a stop sign ticket. And I said, wait a minute, what do you mean? And he said, well, you went through that stop sign when you waved at us. And I said, let me get this straight. You guys were conducting police business on the sidewalk. You saw me go through a stop sign. You jumped in your car in heavy traffic. You followed me from six cars back with little help, with little hope of actually reaching me. And this was all because somebody went through a stop sign, or it had something to do with the fact that it was I who went through a stop sign. Those who are listening should know that you, Steve, served 7 months in jail for defending a woman and child from an assault by a police officer who was subsequently found guilty of using excessive force, right?
Yeah.
That's Officer Lefebvre.
Yeah, by the Citizens Police Review Board, which
right.
is given no authority by the people who run the police department who set it up, the city council. But,
right.
But they did at least they recognized that excessive force was used against the woman and child, which endangered the child. They put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And
Officer Lefebvre is not around to answer any questions because he slipped out of town to another job, and
right.
Citizens Police Review Board chose not to subpoena him or have a public hearing on the issue, so we've got no more information than this sort of three-line description that, oh, this was excessive force.
Yeah, I think it was, according to a source in the city government, it wasn't Lefebvre slipping out of town, though. He was driven out of town. And I think it was a result of all the bad publicity, the fact that we had videotape photos of what he was doing to this woman and child, and all the activism that was done around it, the fact that this was an officer who stated publicly, according to David Silva, that it was his goal to clean the scum off the street of Santa Cruz, which he included the homeless and the political activists in that category. You know, he got a lot of bad publicity. The city council got a lot of bad publicity for it, and we were able to at least drive him out of town. Now he's a cop somewhere else. But.
Right, probably doing the same thing. But at least he's not doing it here, and hopefully, it's always hopefully and usually not really. The police are getting, some kind of check being instituted. I mean, this latest attack on you and the First Amendment, I think, is very serious, just as there's another attack on the First Amendment by the City Council's injunction, I should say, Mayor Fitzmaurice's injunction, Emperor Fitzmaurice's injunction against the Coffee Klatch 3, which goes to court, for anyone who's interested, Thursday at 8:30 in Department 7 at 701 Ocean Street. That's the case in the City Council offices. So there's a lot of stuff we have to be standing together to just say no to. And
Thursday, what's the date on that?
That's Thursday the 8th, February 8th.
Oh, this coming week.
It is, yeah.
Oh, okay.
It's coming right up. So I want to thank you for calling in. Is
All
there
right.
more you want to say?
Keep up the good work.
Hey, thank you.
All right.
You too.
All right, bye.
And you too out there, because it's not just one or two of us that are going to make a difference. It's going to be everybody standing up and asserting their rights and observing and witnessing police actions to make sure that they remain constitutional, that they remain fair. The people are the ultimate check for any kind of injustices that happen. It's not the legislature, it's not the courts, it's not even the jury, as some would say, although the jury can be a check, because one person on the jury can just say no and stop a conviction around the drug war or hassling of homeless people. You can just say no. They can't challenge you, they can't question you. You can say it's my judgment, and you can just take that position. But ultimately, it's the public on the street that has the power, the community that has the power to take action. And the sad thing is that people are so busy and so
consumed with just getting things together to keep alive, given the rent situation and the job situation is just, you know, it's just impossible to deal with. I was up in Berkeley recently, and I ran into one of my favorite poets, Julia Vinograd. I'm going to play for you now kind of a little meeting we had in the Cafe Med on Telegraph Avenue a week or two ago. And she reads a few of her poems, so far unpublished, but probably be published in the next year. She's a wonderful poet. Her books, I'm hoping we can get into the library in Santa Cruz and Mass. I don't know if they sell her in Bookshop Santa Cruz, because Bookshop Santa Cruz hasn't let me walk into their store in 7 years. Neil Coonerty, the owner, decided he didn't like my protests against the downtown ordinances, where I held him accountable for these laws that make it illegal to sit down downtown, ask for a dime in a peaceful way. And indeed, he is one of the primary people responsible. So I can't tell you if there are books in the Bookshop Santa Cruz, but I can certainly let you hear her on the air. Here she is, Julia Vinograd.
Here in Berkeley at about 4:25 in the infamous Cafe Med, or is it the Mediterranean Cafe, with at the table of Julia Vinograd, who is displaying her new Blues for All of Us volume, as well as several, a tape and a CD. And hi, Julia.
Hi.
How's business?
Oh, end of the month-ish, yeah. Other than that, okay.
The weather out there is kind of nasty looking. I mean, it's not raining, but it's not my kind of weather.
No, I like it when it's bright and sunny and everybody is willing to come out and look at things. I hate it both when it's raining and when it looks like it's going to rain any minute.
But perhaps it's a good time for inspiration for a poet, perhaps, or just a good time to be indoors.
Mainly a good time to be indoors. The inspirations have been fairly dark lately because it's...
Dark days?
Yeah, dark days.
In more ways than one?
In more ways than one.
What about Berkeley locally? We know that we got bushwhacked nationally, but what about at the Berkeley level? How are things looking, you know, for people who live in this city?
Well, a lot of the California, you know, things, you know, the right propositions passed and the right people got elected, except for all this weird blackout stuff, which is insane.
And the PG&E profiteering, which is monstrous.
Very much so.
Well, let's see here. You've got a couple of poems you were going to lay on us. These are actually poems that have not been published anywhere else, folks. You hear them here first?
They've been written in the last 2 weeks.
Hot off the pen.
Message. I rode a snail with a burning tail into the night where tombstones swung open like doors and doors swung shut like tombstones. No trespassing on have a nice day. I rode a snail with a burning tail against children set out to play, waving jail cells like butterfly nets with needles for the junkie collection box, where gorgeous wings are no longer troubled by breath. Hang my friends on the wall under glass with labels and admire. I rode a snail with a burning tail against an army of boots coming down on crouched, helpless necks. The weepers saw me coming and scuttled away from my snail's slimy trail, their skins crawling. But they'd let the boots break their ribs in a world where only dieters have a right to eat. I rode a snail with a burning tail into the dark where guns bark like dogs and rub against their owner's knees for food. Into the dark where knives grow on trees, cutting please no out of the night, where large, loose stones and alleys count heads going by like counting sheep until they wake. I rode a snail with a burning tail. I'm delivering mail that isn't written yet. It's up to us. I'm knocking on your door. Open.
Oh, name of that is?
Message.
Come hopefully in the next volume.
Oh, yes. But the next volume won't be till next year. This one just came out.
And is available at Telegraph between Haste and... Lightway?
Yeah. You can get it from me in the coffee house or at Cody's or Shakespeare's.
And you also have another poem here, it looks like.
I better explain, this is not typed yet, so bear with me on the reading.
Take your time, do a leisurely reading.
It's not that. It's reading my bloody handwriting and several different sides of the page. And
give you my interpretation.
It's called Dark Wind. As a dark wind rises and the monsters brush their teeth before dinner, when we're dinner, do something small and set it in your mind like the key to a safe. Monster claws slash and tear, but cannot turn a key. Be safe inside something forgotten, like the sea forgotten in a conch shell, while submarines bomb ships. Buy an orange, peel it slowly, then smell the rough, puckered skin, thick as raw leather. Close your eyes, bite the orange, and let the juice dribble down your chin. Later, if there's blood in the street, you'll see orange peels in the gutter, and you won't have to close your eyes to remember you're human. As a dark wind rises and the monsters brush their teeth before dinner, when we're dinner, take a long hot bath, splashing with your trusted rubber ducky. Draw designs in the soap on your skin and dunk your head, snorting bubbles and bursting up to breathe, till your body is a temple with a congregation inside, kneeling and praying to you, and you're so clean you must be someone else. Then wipe it all away when you wipe the steam off your glasses. Later may be too late for prayer. As a dark wind rises and the monsters brush their teeth before dinner, when we're dinner, pick up a small rounded stone from the vacant lot. Rub your thumb on its speckled cool side and into a hollow, over and over. The stone's unique as your fingerprints. A little dirt clings to its underside where wild yellowed mustard grew close and tall. Think of the vacant lot with mustard blossoms filling the summer sky as you half plant the stone so its long shadow makes a beetle think it's night and time to sleep, far away from breaking glass. As a dark wind rises and the monsters brush their teeth before dinner, when we're dinner, and mustard gas floats over wild mustard in the vacant lot, and guns wear black ties under tinkling chandeliers, set aside one small thing, even from yourself. Everything else can fit inside. You can hide a hymn-filled stained glass cathedral in McDonald's arches if you have to. And you may have to as a dark wind rises and the thunder.
Very nice.
I don't know if nice is exactly the right word. But
very nice.
I write what I feel, and that's how I've been feeling.
Dig it. Anything you want to say to your many fans out there, or and those who just met you?
Well, hello. Well, you know, hold on. We got through Nixon.
I resent that.
And that was Julia Vinograd, reading two of her unpublished poems up in Berkeley. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. Phone lines are open in case you want to join us. We invite you to call in at 427-3772.
Ah! Lisa. If you, then I'll give out without.
And that was by Fits and Starts, a little bit more of Inner City. I'm going to now play a bit of an interview that I did with a really seminal figure, a man who was homeless and then began to help Food Not Bombs up in San Francisco, then began, he went to jail for serving free food himself, as hundreds of us did. At least we were arrested one after another to establish the right of homeless people to serve free food. He's recently written a book, which I'm going to be reviewing for the homeless newspaper Street Spirit. That's the same paper that they're going to supposedly try to be barring from the streets of Santa Cruz without a business license, and we'll see where that goes. Richard Edmondson is also the founder of San Francisco Liberation Radio. Without further ado, let's hear Richard Edmondson, an interview recorded about a week ago. It's a fairly long interview, so we may not get through all of it today, but I guarantee that I will be passing this interview on to a more competent and professional broadcaster here on Free Radio, and he hopefully will make sure that interview in its entirety gets out. Richard Edmondson of Free San Francisco Liberation Radio, which, along with Free Radio Berkeley, was one of the first stations of Liberation Micro Power pirate stations to get on the air and stay on the air. And we've actually, I mean, it's not the first. There's some old, real old timers, but he was there at the beginning. I'm out here on Geary Street at the secret location of San Francisco Liberation Radio, which in fact is none other than the home, catch this all you police officers, of Richard Edmondson. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Robert.
And you are a man of many skills. You're sitting at your computer here in this, looks like living room come radio station. You were one of the founders of San Francisco Liberation Radio. You were a stalwart for San Francisco Food Not Bombs. A man who lived in his vehicle for a number of years. You're a researcher, you're a writer. Just what aren't you, anyway?
Well, I don't know. I'm not a venture capitalist. Not a doctor, I'm not a lawyer. I'm just kind of a jack of all trades. So.
And we're actually here about mid-afternoon, well, 1 o'clock or so, in San Francisco on a kind of a sunny Saturday. And this is a station that's on the air how many hours a day?
We're on the air 7 hours a day. We go on the air each afternoon at 4 p.m., and then we're on until 11 each night, and except on Saturday nights, we go to midnight.
And are you pretty much the man who's doing the station, or is it split by the number of people?
Well, no. I mean, we have some 30 to 40 DJs who come in here and do various programs. We also have, like, a board of directors, of which I'm only one member. There are six or seven altogether, and the board makes all the, like, financial decisions involving the station, and we also have regular DJ meetings in which all the DJs get together and make decisions, like, you know, well, whether or not we want to do a fundraiser or whether we want to sort of support a protest. We recently adopted a proposal to endorse a moratorium on the death penalty, and we signed, you know, that was something Equal Justice USA approached us about, and so all our DJs voted unanimously on that. It was, I'm not by any means the sole means of support of the station.
How many people are actually involved with Free Radio in terms of say starting with the number of DJs, but then just adding, if you add everybody who's involved with the station, what do those numbers look like?
Yeah, everybody that's involved with this station. We have about 30 to 40 DJs. We have, some of the programs that we have are hosted by, like, two or three DJs at one time, and then others, you know, just come in and do individual shows individually. But it's about 30 to 40.
And our, what percentage of your programming is in English?
Oh, just about all of it, in fact. We used to have, and that's a shortcoming of our station, which I feel is certainly an inadequacy about our station. We used to have a program in Chinese, but the lady who was doing that quit, and we haven't been able to replace her yet, so we definitely need more programming in different languages.
Indeed, San Francisco, I mean, Santa Cruz, we of course have a Spanish language as a significant language by a number of people, but San Francisco is really a polyglot city. I mean, you have at least four major languages here, right? Tagalog, Spanish, Chinese, and English, right? And then there are dozens of others that are spoken by smaller groups of people.
Well, in this particular neighborhood here, Russian is widely spoken. We have a Russian Orthodox church just, you know, right down the street here, and that's kind of like made this neighborhood into sort of a hub of Russian-speaking people. But in this neighborhood, we definitely need a Chinese language program, and we definitely need a Russian language program. And
so we should put out an appeal in Chinese and Russian for any, say, expatriate Santa Cruzans who wish to step forward and parla paruski, or I'm not sure how you'd say it in Chinese.
That would be great, yeah.
The station has been on the air since 1993?
Yeah, since May 1st of 1993. That was our maiden broadcast.
And indeed, you are famous for roaming the hills in your truck to, should we say, one step ahead of the, well, what you feared was the FCC and the police, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, we started out in, doing totally mobile broadcasting out of my truck, and we would drive it up to places like Potrero Hill or Twin Peaks and set up the antenna and turn the transmitter on and you know, broadcast for about 2 or 3 hours and then break down and go home. And we were doing this to start out with just once a week, and we sort of gradually expanded to twice a week. And then about 5 or 6 months after we went on the air, the FCC tracked me down one night while I was doing one of these mobile broadcasts.
As portrayed in your recent book, Rising Up, Class Warfare in America from the Streets to the Airwaves, which hopefully will be available in the Santa Cruz Public Library soon, you give a very kind of detailed account of what happened there, and I think you've also talked about this on the air as well.
It was a kind of a strange night. I was in the back of my truck. It's a little motorhome camper type truck.
Truck that's parked in front of your home here?
Yeah, that one.
Hasn't been towed or hauled away?
No, not yet. It needs to be towed right now because it won't run. But
and you lived in this truck for a number of years.
I did, yes.
In fact, as Rising Up documents, you were also one of the primary reasons you got involved with this free radio movement was because you felt that what had happened to homeless people in San Francisco was simply not getting out through the mainstream media?
That's correct. I mean, people were having their their shopping carts taken, their belongings, their clothes, their sleeping bags.
Their vehicles?
Their vehicles, too, yes. There's one famous case of a man who died one night in the bushes outside of the Haight Street McDonald's after having his sleeping bag and his prescription medicine taken by the cops earlier that evening.
I remember I was across the street doing video work with Coalition on Homelessness several days before. They ticketed me for being in the park.
That's not surprising. They were doing a lot of that back then, and this gentleman died after having this sort of tragic, you know, encounter with the San Francisco police. And this is the sort of thing that was going on, and, you know, not to mention the whole outrage of arresting people for serving food to homeless people, which you well know about that. And so we decided that, you know, things that were going on back then were like the city was saying, well, Food Not Bombs just refuses to get a permit. Mm-hmm. They just refuse to apply for a permit. And the city would tell these lies, not only to the media, but they would tell them to judges, federal judges.
And get away with them.
And get away with it. There's, you know, one famous case quoted in my book with Deputy City Attorney Paula Jessen went before federal judge Andrew Schwartzer and said, Your Honor, we've tried and tried, but they just refused to get a permit. And so we felt like, one thing we wanted to do with the radio station was to focus on this whole issue of, you know, how outrageous it, not only how outrageous it is to be arresting people for serving food, but also to expose some of these lies that the city was telling.
How successful have you been? Now, I noticed this book, which you self-published after apparently getting dissed by numerous publishers whose names we shall not mention, you go into some detail about Food Not Bombs. I know I worked for a number of years doing flyers for Food Not Bombs and compiling archives. Keith McHenry, one of the main co-founder of Food Not Bombs and one of the main targets of the police around Food Not Bombs, was his computer was constantly breaking down. He was losing his archives, and we were always having trouble doing that, and indeed I think some of his stuff is still stored down in Santa Cruz, but there was a problem getting information out to the public. Though occasionally you get a good story, one or two stories. Mostly it was this mythology, as often is with free radio, that permits are just not being applied for by these anarchistic pirates who just want to snub their, turn their noses up and give the finger to authority, and they're all about acting in an adolescent, rebellious fashion without any substance involved. The truth, however, is quite different, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, the truth was certainly a lot different between, you know, in the case of Food Not Bombs. In the case of free radio, of course, you know, the FCC has opened up these filing windows, and thousands of people have filed applications now.
But not for urban areas, correct? There's no way to get a radio station in San Francisco here. Is that a correct understanding?
Under the rules that they have passed, there is no way of getting a radio station here in San Francisco. However, we have filed an application and requested a waiver on that rule. We actually have two applications pending with the FCC. But getting back to Food Not Bombs, though, I mean, there was a whole... I mean, the city was saying, oh, they just refused to apply for a permit, but the reality was that Food Not Bombs members were spending literally hundreds of hours meeting with city officials in negotiations and putting in their time for free, while city officials, of course, were being paid for having all these meetings and so forth. So this claim made by the city that, oh, we've tried to work with Food Not Bombs and they just refused to apply for a permit, that was just an outright fabrication. And you know, again, one which, you know, we felt like we wanted to address on the radio. It was one of the reasons why we put this radio station on the air.
And one of the reasons you wrote this book, which in quite systematic detail goes into the history of the Food Not Bombs struggle to get a permit. And indeed, it did get a permit for a period of time in 1989 and 90. It had kind of month-to-month permits, and then, of course, the entire permit process was removed by Parks and Rec in the summer of 1990. So actually, it's still the case, as I understand it, that it is illegal. You can't get a permit to serve free food in a park. Is that still the case?
My understanding is that to serve food for groups of 25 or more, it's illegal to do that in a city park. But I mean, they bend the rules every year when they have this what is it they call it, Park a la Mode, and they have all these restaurants come out to the park and set up tents and serve food. So I mean, it seems to be applied very selectively.
Similar to how in, let's say, Santa Cruz, it's illegal to serve food except from a certified kitchen. This is the other thing that has been used statewide to go after food servers under the state codes. They claim you have to have a certified kitchen. They went after Food Not Bombs and Swap, Soup Without a Permit, feeders in Santa Cruz in 1989, claiming that we didn't have a certified kitchen, which is, of course, a restaurant kitchen. I think it's three sinks and so forth. But, of course, their own interface satellite shelter program, the city's own interface satellite shelter program, which every night makes food for the people that comes there, they don't have certified kitchens. And they violate the city's own camping ban law because they aren't domiciles. I mean, they, of course, as you pointed out, they stretch their laws and ignore laws for themselves, but for outlaw groups, of course, or for groups they don't, disfavored groups is the way to put it, they act differently. On the other hand, Liberation Radio is sort of a haven for some disfavored groups, though I doubt you have any Nazis who broadcast from this station.
No, we don't have any Nazis.
So you exercise censorship, Richard Edmondson?
Yeah. I mean, I freely admit that. We would not allow a Nazi or a KKK member to come on this station.
How about a Republican?
A Republican, that might be, you know, stretching it a little bit, but possibly we would have a Republican.
Libertarian?
Yeah, we've actually had libertarians on before.
Natural Rights Party.
Don't know much about them, so no, we've never had any of them on.
So, in fact, of course, the reason in Santa Cruz, the collective has the same philosophy. They don't want hate speech, as they put it. They have a number of rules that sometimes bother me about... I mean, I've had a Nazi on my show, for instance, a homeless Nazi, to talk about, you know, that perspective. But, you know, it's not like he's got a regular forum to speak or to push his particular point of view. But there is a way that anybody who wants to get a transmitter can, for a relatively small amount of money, do so, set one up, and begin broadcasting, though at the risk of potential harassment, though indeed there hasn't been too much harassment in California, except, I guess it's Free Radio Berkeley. And I guess you yourself did close down for a while after an unfavorable court decision in 1998, but theoretically, other stations have not been harassed, they've been harassed by people going to the landlord and so forth, but you actually haven't had stations where SWAT teams come in, grab the equipment, as has happened in Florida and in what? Is it Illinois, I think, was also another place that that happened.
Yeah, that's well, it happened recently in Springfield, Illinois. Austin, Texas, was Free Radio Austin was raided by a SWAT team twice and had all their equipment taken. But no, we've not had that sort of attack against us here. There have been a couple of cases of a couple of different radio micro stations in San Francisco whose landlords were approached by the FCC, who did make some sort of threatening comments to the landlords, and the landlords went and shut down the radio stations. But we haven't had any direct attacks like FCC raids like that here.
So other folks who wanted, like Nazis, if they wanted to set up their own station, they could do so at a relatively cheaply.
Yeah, there would be nothing stopping them.
Why do you think this hasn't happened more broadly in San Francisco? I mean, there have been a couple of stations, like Radio Equis, is it called?
Yeah, Radio Equis, they called it Radio X. That was the one that had their landlord approached by the FCC.
Spanish-speaking?
Yeah, in the Mission District, and primarily Spanish-speaking. They were putting out a lot of news about the Zapatista Rebellion, about INS raids in the Mission District. It's really a tragic loss for the Mission District to lose that radio station.
And how long was it on? From what period? And what period?
Oh, it was on for about 2 years, from about, maybe 95 to 97 or 96 to 98, something like that.
Why do you think that there hasn't been more stations, and particularly in the Bay Area, that have come online? I know that Berkeley also has only had pretty much one station that I've heard of, first called Free Radio Berkeley, and then I guess they changed their name and their dial number to it, and they're currently broadcasting still. But what's the reason?
Well, I mean, there was a Radio Califia, which broadcast in Berkeley, and they got FCC pressure. A lot of them who made up that collective were undocumented immigrants, and I think this is like the FCC and the INS got together and said, let's put some pressure on these people. But anyway, that's what happened. That radio station closed down as well. It wasn't a case of landlord pressure in that particular case. It was a case of most of them being afraid because they were undocumented immigrants to continue broadcasting.
What years did they broadcast?
Oh, that was 3-4 years ago, something like that. They were on the air only for a brief time. There's Berkeley Liberation Radio, and they're going strong over there now, which is kind of an offshoot of Free Radio Berkeley.
24 hours a day?
Yeah, 24 hours. Yeah, I think so, 24 hours.
Bigger collective than San Francisco Liberation Radio?
I would say so, probably, yeah.
Do they have, you mentioned you have a board of directors here. Are you actually an official nonprofit, or do you have nonprofit status, or?
No, I mean, if you mean like an official 501c3 status, no, we don't have that. We just have, a group of about seven who sort of make the financial decisions for the station and sort of set the policy. One thing we're going to be taking up at our next meeting is this issue of drinking alcohol on the premises. It hasn't been a problem only insofar as, mostly just insofar as empty bottles being left around the studio, but we did have a case come up about 2-3 weeks ago where a DJ got very drunk on the air. So we're going to take this issue up in our next meeting. But yeah, that's the sort of thing that the board deals with.
So what is the cost to start a free radio station? Again, I refer people to your book, Rising Up, Class Warfare in America, From the Streets to the Airwaves, and we are talking with Richard Edmondson here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. San Francisco pioneer in micropower radio. What does it cost to do this?
Well, what it would cost today, I guess, would probably be somewhere around $1,000 to $1,500 if you include buying your audio equipment. Obviously, you need a mixer. There's a lot more you need besides just the transmitter and an antenna. You need a mixer, a CD player, tape deck, etc., and so on. And audio equipment is something you can spend a little bit of money on, or a great deal of money on, and just depending on what your tastes are and how the quality of sound that you want to try to achieve. But I would say you could probably put one on the air for like $1,000 to $1,500, $1,200, something like that.
And you'd have to pay rent as well.
Well, yeah, unless you just like we're doing it here in an apartment where two of us are already living and paying rent anyway. So
the upkeep of the station is per month, not including rent, what would you estimate?
Well, actually, the radio station does pay towards the rent here in this apartment. The station pays, I think it's $105 a month, which is pretty
right,
cheap.
But if you got your rent free, I mean, you have to pay rent, whatever it is, but once you pay your rent, how much does it cost to keep the equipment going, that sort of thing?
Very little, actually, unless you have, occasionally CD players and tape decks do break down, and, you do have to replace one.
$100 per month? Or?
No, I wouldn't say it would be that much. I guess our biggest expense is like long-distance phone calls, buying tapes. We've been fortunate. We haven't had an equipment breakdown here in a while now, so we haven't had to spend any money on buying new tape new tape decks or CD players. Knock on wood, I hope that continues for a while. But operating a micro radio station, it really doesn't cost very much money. It's very low overhead.
What are the greatest achievements in terms of the content that you've been able to get out on San Francisco Liberation Radio over the last, 8 years of being on the air?
And we'll be going into San Francisco Liberation Radio's greatest hits a bit later. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz at 96.3 FM, and I'm your host, Bathrobes Pierre Robert Norse. I do a show every Sunday. Our show will go till 1:30. I'm going to take a look back now at a local Santa Cruz matter, a rather serious one that happened on January 20th. I've already played a bit of discussion of this, some interviews, some call-in, kind of back and forth on it. But I haven't had much of a chance to talk to the man who actually was at the center of this thing in terms of being the victim, and that was Sean Duncan. I've been able to reach him on the phone. I'm going to call him during the course of this brief taping, and we're going to get him live on the air, hopefully, and he can give us an update on what's been happening. This was an incident where a protest against the Bush inauguration, that's quote, President, unquote, Bush, there was a protest that's happening around the post office, town clock area, and a motorist struck a bicyclist. Joe Gutierrez was the motorist, Sean Duncan was the bicyclist. I'm going to play you now the interview I had with Joe Gutierrez, which, again, the tape is questionable quality, but you can catch most of it. And then we're going to talk to Sean and hear what's been happening. Has been, as I've said, covered extensively in the Metro by a Metro writer who actually was there and was somewhat dumbfounded at what went on. And I believe she says even her story was toned down by the Metro, and it still makes quite fascinating reading in last week's Metro. But here again is a replay of the Joe Gutierrez interview of January 20th.
People here in front of the post office. Sir, would you like to make a statement for Free Radio? What happened?
Well, I voted for Gore.
Right. And there was an incident involving a vehicle of some sort?
Yes.
What was that about? What happened? I wasn't here. I didn't see it.
Well, it's my understanding it's best not to make a statement at all.
Okay, but you feel, they're claiming that you intentionally hit this guy. You deny that.
Right.
Who you voted for is not an issue.
Absolutely deny it. I would never intentionally try and hit somebody.
And are you just downtown on business, or?
Yes, it's 12:51. I'm trying to get to the bank before 1 o'clock, and I'm not going to make it.
So what happened after this bicycle incident occurred? Were you?
Well, fortunately, I was at the mercy of the mob because I had to stop since there was an accident, and the mob was merciful. They did not damage my vehicle, and they did not damage me. So,
the story I heard from a couple of other individuals was that you either inadvertently or intentionally, I guess some people thought it was intentionally, hit this bicyclist.
No, I was avoiding the car in front of me, trying to make a right turn, and I was accelerating and stopping at the same time as the reason my wheel squealed. It was not because I was trying to run the guy over. I was hitting the brakes while the car was still accelerating.
This was as you were coming down the hill from Mission, or you were...
No, I was stopped at the light because the people were crossing the street against the light.
Right.
And I had a green, and there were several cars in front of me. I decided the least path of least resistance was to make a right turn. Mm-hmm. And the guy with the bicyclist rode his bike in front of me when I'm clearly trying.
Gas over his bike.
Why did you step on the gas so hard?
He was.
Why were your tires squealing?
Because I was stopping and accelerating at the same time. So my front wheels weren't rolling, my back wheels were squealing.
You were trying to go somewhere fast.
You felt you were responding in a fashion to stop, was that the
yes,
idea?
Yes, absolutely, trying to stop. The guy rode his bike in front of me, I stopped as fast as I could.
And then why did you take off again then? Why was it to get and then go again?
Why did I take off?
Yeah. Why did you get and then there was another crash? What is that? Well, I don't understand why not being arrested for assault with deadly weapons. I don't understand.
So your perception is that that's not what happened, that you in fact were...
No, I was avoiding any accident or confrontation it the whole time. So I'm sorry, but, you know, that's the truth. I would never intentionally try and run the guy over.
Well, it looked like that.
Were you yelling at the bicyclist?
No, not at all. I wasn't yelling anything at anybody.
Why were you staying still in the path until the path was clear? Why did you force your way through?
I didn't.
That's a pretty good question. I don't have an answer yet.
So, you're trying to get to the bank, and
exactly.
Now you're waiting for the police to deal with this matter.
Exactly. This is going to take quite a long time. Never in my wildest dreams would I have imagined this to happen.
Have you spoken to the bicyclist yet?
No, but actually I did, yeah.
And what did he want to
do? He's fine, but his bike is going to need to be fixed.
Did you exchange names with the bicyclist and phone numbers?
I think the police officer is taking care of that.
And your name is?
My name is Joe Gutierrez.
Any feelings one way or the other about the protest when you started out this morning?
Headed for Gore.
Right. Would this make you pro, con, or in the middle?
I don't even know what you're protesting or why. All I know is that they were crossing the street against the light. And I was trying to avoid the crowd.
Right. Are you going to help pay for the bicycle?
And do anything else I have to do to take if the guy's injured or whatever. But I didn't see any injury. He didn't claim any injury.
Can I get your age?
What are you?
Oh, I work for the Sentinel. I'm just covering the whole thing. So this happened, so it's part of it. So.
Delsing. Reach Delsing.
And where were you standing?
And that was January 20th. Interview with Joe Gutierrez, the motorist who struck Sean Duncan. We have on the line Sean Duncan. Hi, Sean.
Hi, Robert.
And you not only heard that interview, you actually, put it on the Internet, right?
Yes, I did. I got that out there for many folks to hopefully hear and share, and that along with the police report.
Or lack of police report?
Yeah.
What about the... I want to talk to you about the police report, but I wonder about this Internet. How can people access this if they want? If they want to hear this again, how can they?
Actually, if people have a copy of the Metro article, there's the link to my personal website's posted at the end of that, and I could read that on the air as well, if that would be useful. Or
sure, or if people want that, they can, of course, call the Metro at 457-9000 or call HUF, which is offline number for this Bathrop Spears Broadsides program, 423-HUF, 423-4833. But
or they can feel free to send me an email as well. I'm Ashawn at CATS. That's A-S-H-A-W-N at CATS.UCSC.edu.
Now, have you gotten much response to this posting on the Internet?
Most of the response, I believe, has been more from posts that I've sent to various mail lists, both on the UC campus as well as local bicycle mail lists. It's really hard to tell what's actually coming from people seeing the website or what's coming from people just seeing me posting to these various groups and whatnot.
Now, you heard Joe Gutierrez's account of events. Mm-hmm. You obviously have a somewhat different sort of under the wheels account of events.
Yes.
You want to give that account?
Where should I begin?
Wherever you'd like.
Well, I'll just begin in the right before we'll call it the collision took place, and which was essentially myself navigating through this overly congested intersection with both people and cars, and kind of following the flow of humans both on bicycles as well as on foot across the street. When I was trying to basically aim the bicycle with the clock tower behind me down Pacific Avenue, As I was going behind Joe's truck there, he you know, aggressively was, you know, going in reverse, and as I swerved around him while he was still in reverse, you know, I shouted at him, "Hey, look out or watch out," something to that effect. And I feel, personally, I feel that's really the straw that broke his back, and you know, he just, you know, caused him to snap. And as I was riding into the, you know, basically trying to aim down Pacific Avenue, he put it in drive and came after me, and definitely made contact and then some. And you know, the thing that I really tried to make clear to the officer at the scene, you know, regardless of intention, I mean, I could feel the you know, the vehicle not slowing down, actually the force, you know, increasing after he made contact with myself and the bicycle, which is why I was at one point and he and the bicycle were, you know, a good 5 or 6 feet down the street, and then he kept going, and that's of course where the